Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
By the way, you heard Tom talking about his forum. NPR News is in the middle of this year-long project to determine what divides us as a state and a nation and where we have common ground. That forum that Tom hosted was part of that. The project is called Ground Level. You can learn all about it at NPR News/Ground Level. Back to our conversation now. I'm bringing in Suzanne Chaud. She's an associate professor of political science at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois. And Suzanne, welcome to the show. It's good to talk to you today.
It's good to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to ask you what I've been asking our audience and what I asked Ken to think about, and that's this Pew question in a very interesting poll in December. Americans believe there's more political conflict between Republicans and Democrats than racial or income gap conflict. And I wondered if you'd reflect on what you hear in that answer.
Well, it's such an interesting question to begin with. I mean, typically we assume that there's always partisan difference. We've seen that there's been partisan differences since, 1787, for example. Mm-hmm. But the idea now that the root of the divide in American politics is simply explained by partisanship as opposed to things that underlie partisanship is an interesting phenomenon in and of itself. And part of it, I think, is that we want to assume that we are classless. We want to assume that we are post-racial. We want to assume that we are post-feminist. And so, of course, those aren't the divisions that we need to talk about. We need to talk about just partisan fighting. And I think what's problematic about that is that we sweep the things under the rug that underlie partisan ideology and simply say, well, if you're a Democrat, I think that you are everything that's wrong with America. And if you're a Republican, I think that you're everything that's wrong with America and you're out to ruin everything. It's an easy shortcut, for example, and it keeps us from having the deeper conversations that we should be having, the hard conversations we should be having. And these are the kinds of things that we try to do in academia. And while I shouldn't say that the media doesn't do those things the way that we do, it's a little bit harder to understand a soundbite about racism and sexism and classism, for example, than it is about a new Pew poll that says that, everyone hates everyone.
I think this is a really good point. And I hear you when you say we've gotten into a political world here where if you're a Democrat, you are the following six things.
Yes.
If you're a Republican, you are the following six things. And
yes,
that incorporates all these complex issues that we're talking about, race and class and other beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, the shortcut is, well, I don't have to talk about that because I've already made up my mind on those six things when you call yourself a Democrat. Political identity, right? Much more complicated.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Go ahead.
I'm agreeing. That's absolutely correct. And I try to do this in my classes where, you think that you are a Democrat or Republican. Well, let's talk about what that actually means, right? What are the core values that underlie an ideology? And how do you subscribe or do you not subscribe to those core values? And then what does that mean about how you feel about policy and equality and size of government and all of that? And when you take a step back and really look at it, we have a little more in common than we think, but that's really difficult to do. And we are so quick to, as you said, and as I said before, just assume things about people and even assume things about yourself.
For sure.
And when we don't take the time to listen to each other, I tell my students often, it's not that we're not listening to each other. It's like we're speaking different languages.
I really love what you just said, Suzanne, about listening to yourself, because mm-hmm. I think in some of these conversations we've had specifically about this, if you have to articulate to some your own beliefs to somebody who is actively listening with engagement, you learn more about what you know and what you don't know and what you believe and don't believe. That's a really good test. It's a great exercise.
I think that that's right. And it's hard. It's hard to take a look at yourself. It's easy to look at others and point fingers and say you're this, that, and the other and dismiss. But when you have to look at yourself and say, what do I believe and why do I believe it and what am I willing to do to forward those beliefs, it gives you pause, as it should. We should all be doing that exercise.
Christine says on Twitter, there's no conversation, just battles. Mm-hmm. Facts don't seem to matter. It's also defeating. not feeling hopeful at all this year. I want to come back to you, Susanna, something that I was talking to Ken about, and I was not thinking so specifically about the hard and fast facts. I was thinking about how using statistics is not in the emotional discussion around politics, does not seem to be very persuasive to your political opposite.
That's right, that facts are no longer just facts, for example. And, you know, what's really interesting about this is we saw this with the Alabama special election. Again, talking to students about it, it's always a reference point for me being in the classroom all the time, asking, you know, did you talk to your family about these things when you were over the holidays and all of this? And we just assume that, well, if you're this party or you're that party, that you're just going to vote for this particular person, regardless of what they've done or didn't do and so on and so forth. And you look at the polls and they say this or they say that. And it's really about looking at looking a little bit deeper than that. And when you present the statistics to people, they say, oh, well, no, I don't believe that because that was done by this outlet, or this outlet. Or I don't think that you're reading those correctly. Or you look at a poll and you don't look at the methodology. Well, what's the standard error? What's the margin of error? How many people were there that were in the poll and so forth? And, I mean, this could take me into a whole discussion about the 2016 election polls, but I won't go there. But it is difficult to present statistics to someone and say this is, you know, capital T truth, because that's subject to objectivity somehow. Subjectivity now.
Yes, right. Let's go to some of our listeners here, to Jeff in Lakeville. Jeff, you sound like you're frustrated. About what?
I guess frustrated that there's this assumption that no one is actually talking to each other. I have very strong political views, and I associate with people that have very strong opposing political views.
That's good.
And we talk all the time. It means that just by communicating, we come to an agreement. I mean, neither of us are in a position to actually make the policy decisions. So compromise between our two positions don't really accomplish anything.
But Jeff, so, yes, it does, because what you're doing is breaking down that demonization that I was talking with Ken Rudin about. And that seems to be the characteristic that infuses a lot of our political differences. Mm-hmm. When you can talk in a truly engaged way with somebody who's your political opposite, it's almost impossible to demonize them if they're really listening to you, right?
But I wonder if the demonization is more about what is shown on TV than about interpersonal communication. Because I hear the demonization, but I only hear it on the radio.
I don't know.
Hear it on TV.
Gotten a lot of calls from people who say I can't be with my family. But Suzanne, please go ahead.
No, I want to say, I think to the caller, it's a really good point. It's not, you know, I don't think anyone's trying to say no one talks to each other and no one has these conversations and that people don't actually listen. That's absolutely not true. That you're a perfect example of people that do that. And I think what is frustrating, and I hear you saying it as a citizen, and I will say it as a political scientist, is that yes, what we tend to see on, you know, on TV, for example, are people who are demonizing each other because it's sexy and it gets ratings. And I heard you, Carrie, talking about confirmation bias earlier. Mm-hmm. It feeds into that as well. And then for those of us that are having enlightened conversations and are trying to come to some kind of understanding with someone who's different from us, it does make it feel futile. Well, why am I doing this? Because as the caller said, we're not making policy. So what does it matter whether we understand each other if those in power don't understand each other?
But the answer to that, Suzanne, is then we don't choose politicians who refuse to be so dogmatic
and demagogue
the issues. Go ahead.
I think that is right. And one thing that may sound a little bit Pollyanna, but I really do believe is true, is that if we demand to be heard, then we will be listened to. But if we don't tell our elected officials that we require something different or there are actual electoral consequences,
right,
then they are going to continue to behave as they behave. The media continues to cover them as they behave. And then we kind of go round and round in a circle. And so, you know, institutions and government are designed to serve those in the institutions. And the hope, the framers hoped that those institutions would then serve our interests. And we have found that there is now this gap between what serves them in some ways and what serves us. But until we demand that we are served in the way that we need to be, we're going to continue to feel as if we are being left out.
Shoot, I was going to go back to Jeff, and I think he just had to hang up. But I wondered if we've been persuasive. Let me grab a call here from Jordan in Apple Valley. Hi, Jordan. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hello, yes.
Hi. Tell me how you're thinking about this.
Yeah, well, so I grew up conservative evangelical Christian, and so a lot of my extended family and social networks and things like that fit that, and I'm neither now. But I still would have a lot of really profound and respectful conversations with people that disagreed with me.
Good.
Up until really last year, year and a half ago or so, you saw, all these people betray so many values that had been espoused as, like, this is what you need to do, this is what you need to be. And I lost almost all respect and credibility for them. And in their place, I saw them pursuing actions that could only be explained with really abhorrent beliefs that harmed me and my loved ones. And it's really hard to be patient and tolerant with that.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh, Jordan. Yes, yeah. Yeah, but Jordan, you know how complex a person's religious faith and their political views are. I mean, just to summarize somebody who normally you think you might have common ground with, but just to say they hold abhorrent views, I don't need to know anything else about them, is kind of the opposite of what I'm advocating for here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you probably share more values than you'd ever expect with some of
the... I think my point was that where I had previously started from a baseline of a benefit of the doubt,
okay,
now someone's coming at me saying, hey, I'm Republican, I'm conservative, I voted for Trump, I'm evangelical, stuff like that. My priors are now, this is going to be a heavy lift.
Okay.
No, I can absolutely see that that's true, especially one of the things that we assume that voting is very rational, but in some ways voting is much more emotional. Politics is very emotional and it's visceral. And if we've been taught this, I think, for sure, since this last election.
I mean, this is something I was trying to talk with Ken about, which is, even though I think a lot of us, Suzanne, believe that we make a choice to support a candidate or a party by ticking off, well, they stand for this and they stand for that. Mm-hmm. People like you know how much emotion actually goes into aligning yourself with a candidate.
Absolutely. Especially because we are a candidate-centered system. While we are partisan, there is no question. We compare to other nations where it's much more about party and much less about the individual candidate. And we are not that way. And so that rapport, that kind of intimate connection that we make to candidates in particular is something that's really hard to shake. And just to give a quick example, we look, we see Oprah Winfrey giving her speech on the Golden Globes last night, mm-hmm. and there's this Oprah 2020 all over the place. And yeah, there's something emotional about looking at particularly a woman of color on a stage like that, espousing these things that people feel have been, left behind in the past year. But let's take a step back for a minute and look at what we're criticizing Trump for in terms of his qualifications. It's just, take a minute and take emotion out for
good,
a second.
Good
which is hard
point.
To do.
Yes. Not that Oprah would be unqualified, but Suzanne, your point is so well taken. I mean, there are people going, he had no experience and look mm-hmm. at this. Well, it's perhaps the American public is willing to consider more people who come into that office without a lot of political experience. Oprah.
We've done it once.
Right.
Yeah.
Eric in Milwaukee, Wisconsin called to say there's a huge divide amongst the parties, but I also don't think people believe Republicans are bringing down the country, but rather Trump is through his intimidation tactics. Suzanne, I wanted to read that because mm-hmm. there's also confusion about the personality of the candidate mm-hmm. as being how should I put this? As being everything you need to know about mm-hmm. what a person stands for and what the party stands for. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of mashup of that, I think, with Trump.
Yeah, and I will say to the first point that what the data have told us is that it's not that this pattern of, everyone that's in this party is what's wrong with the nation and this party is wrong with the nation, that pattern existed before Trump became president. And so I think it's exacerbated it, though, because the party and sort of Trumpian politics have collapsed.
Yes.
And so now we see, I think there was an assumption or a hope on the part of Republicans in Congress that Trump would kind of be enveloped into the Republican Party and become a Republican. And what we've seen is that the party has moved and become Trump's party. And I think for Republican voters who were hoping that the Republican establishment can kind of rein him in, his advisors would tell him to kind of do what Ryan is saying, do what McConnell is saying, and the exact opposite has occurred, we may have some regretful voters. And we've definitely seen a stalemate, for example, in Congress, except for the tax bill, because they still can't quite figure out what the party looks like.
Suzanne Chaud is with us if you've just gotten in on the conversation. She's an associate professor of political science at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois. On Mondays, we're going to talk politics. We'll talk with Ken Rudin, of course, the political junkie, for his inside view of Washington. But I want to talk with big thinkers on politics from the rest of the country, too. And I'll be asking you to think about some larger political, like philosophical questions, like the one that Pew was putting to Americans on conflicts between Republicans and Democrats, stronger, more fractious than conflicts between black and white Americans and rich and poor Americans. And we've heard some great insight and nuance on that question. So that's what we'll be doing on Mondays to Paul in Rochester. Hi, Paul. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah.
Tell me what you're thinking about.
Well, I just wondered if anybody had noticed or spoken to. I was looking in the World Almanac, and if you look at the state of Minnesota and the way it voted in the last election, the entire map, county by county, is red, except for the metro areas are blue. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like the city mouse and the country mouse have reached a disagreement about things. And I'm rural, and I noticed that the people that I most associate with or that I run into on a day-to-day are more conservative viewed. Mm-hmm. Everybody's sprinkled through like salt and pepper, I would say, but it definitely tends to be, these are bootstrap people that are living out on the land that are like, you know, get to work, earn it, go get it, you know. And even to sit and listen to you at times talk about the racial divide and stuff, I didn't feel racial until it was, you know, that drum was beat on too long, and it's like, well, what is the deal here, you know? But what's the difference between the city mouse and the country mouse? Why do they see it so differently, I guess, is my question.
This is so, I'm so glad you waited, Paul, because you said some things just now about who, I think the mythology around who rural people are and who city people are. Suzanne, did you pick up on that?
Yeah, I did. And when I love this comment, and it takes us back, Carrie, to the first question you asked, the Pew question about, you know, it's party as opposed to class and race and other things. And I think what's so important here is that what we used to see is that the blue collar worker, the rural worker, kind of the working class white man, you know, that was the bread and butter of the Democratic Party all the way through Bill Clinton's administration. Mm. His ability to speak to use the term, although I don't like this term, the kind of the angry white man, right? Like, mm-hmm. what about me? And I've been left behind. And this sort of, like you said, like the caller said, the bootstrap workers, you know, Bill Clinton was able to kind of piggyback off of what FDR was able to do, keep them in, keep them close. And as the Democratic Party began to become more inclusive, began to, you know, become more progressive, those, the bread and butter of the Democratic Party, those white working class men, were like, well, what about me? What about my needs? What about, I'm struggling as well. And this is why Donald Trump was really successful. He tapped into that frustration and that, you know, where am I in the conversation in a way that the Democratic Party wasn't able to do, Hillary Clinton wasn't able to do. And the question is going to be now is that those workers, those white working class men who felt left behind by the Democratic Party, are they feeling left behind by this president, or are they feeling like they're being heard?
The other thing that I like to do is listen for what I call the language of mythology, right? And it was interesting because Paul said they live on the, you know, he was talking about he and his rural friends and co-residents, I guess. They live on the land. They're bootstrap people. Yep. Those people in the cities. I think that's mythology. Mm-hmm. There may be grains of truth to that, mm-hmm. but I don't think that people in the city would automatically say, well, we don't believe in a good day's hard work for
right.
a fair wage, right? We have a lot more that we share, I think, about the idea of who we are as Americans.
Mm-hmm. It's
than
the,
you would think.
I think that you're right. It's this perception of sort of the elite bubble. And if you're in
right.
it, you don't understand what's outside of it, and you think that your bubble is the best bubble. And when that's what's dominating the news, what's dominating politics, what's dominating Hollywood and all of that, you do start to feel like nobody understands who you are. And again, it goes back to talking to each other and listening to each other. And if we do it in small ways, you know, small ways add up to big things.
Call here from Ephraim in Minneapolis. Hi, Ephraim. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well.
So the divisions between politics, it's not just in politics. It's also in religion. I find I'm Catholic, and I find that there's an inability between conservative Catholics and liberal Catholics to actually speak to one another. There's just something about this culture that's causing this inability to communicate.
Super interesting. So are you saying, Ephraim, within your own faith community, you can really see the political divisions, and that means, you know, the people in the congregation are less likely to share life experience with each other?
Absolutely. There seems to be like a culture of pre-Vatican II versus post-Vatican II people. And there's just this sides that will not talk to one another.
What do you make of that, Suzanne?
Excuse me. I think that's so interesting. We've talked about, particularly with the Catholic faith, that, you know, abortion is one of those cross-cutting issues that have tended to sort of separate those in the Catholic faith. And what I think what we're seeing now, and we see this, I think, not just with the Catholic faith, but with others, is that, and I would say maybe particularly now with the Jewish community, that depending on how you feel about one or two issues, and those cross-cutting issues are going to send you one way as opposed to the other, that didn't keep people within a faith community from communicating. But now, because those divisions are deeper and they seem wider and they seem harder to cross because of the way that they're discussed and the way that they are, the way that we are made to think that there's no way we can ever come together again on these issues, then yeah, it becomes harder to sit next to someone at a pew and say like, oh, well, we disagree on this one thing, but we still are rooted together in these other things.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking about this with the next generation, the students that you're teaching, Suzanne, and I caught a discussion with Howard Dean, former presidential candidate and ran the Democratic Party for a while. And was talking to NPR about the next generation and this generation of Democratic leaders getting out of the way. So listen to how he put it.
The most important age group for us is people under 35. They elected Barack Obama in 2008. But now it's time to let them take over. And they're going to have to take over on their own terms. We have tons of talent in our party. We do not need to rely on my generation anymore. And these kids think differently. They're more respectful of each other. They're willing to listen to each other's ideas and work things out. They're entrepreneurial. They're more conservative than we are economically, than the left wing of the Democratic Party. They're mostly libertarian. I just think this is the future of America. We need a real change in this country. And the only way to do it is to get out, for us to get out.
Is he romanticizing the next generation, Suzanne? Or would you agree with that?
I think that there's some truth in what he is saying, absolutely. I think there's some overgeneralizations. For example, I wouldn't say that most of this generation are libertarian or more fiscally conservative than previous generations. I also would not necessarily say that they're more open-minded and listening to each other than other generations.
You say they are or are
no,
not?
No, I wouldn't say that they are.
They are not.
I would not say that they are. Again, stereotyping across the whole millennial generation, I wouldn't say that that's necessarily the case. I do think that the way that they communicate with each other is different because most of them communicate in a virtual world and not in the real world. We talk about, you know, building social capital and building relationships virtually as opposed to in person. And so there is a different way of communicating. I don't know that it's more open. The anonymity of comments, for example, online has created a level of intolerance we haven't seen before. I think what's interesting about this generation is that what we know and the data tell us, for example, is that the millennial generation are less likely to vote but more likely to join a cause, to protest, to donate to a candidate, and to be involved in social justice issues.
And is that because of the diminished trust in institutions, including government, or is there something else at work there?
I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, the younger generation we know across time is less likely to vote for a whole host of reasons. Mm-hmm. But this generation, as Howard Dean said, the Barack Obama generation, where there was a call to involvement, much like Bobby Kennedy did in the late 60s, mm-hmm. a call to involvement from somebody that you can connect to in a way you couldn't before, has created a more social justice-oriented generation. And that is fantastic. How this translates, though, to running for office, that, especially for young women and people of color, is much harder to cross than I think Howard Dean is giving it, is saying that it is.
Well, that's pretty discouraging. And when you say that, are you saying that then goes back to government isn't the place that we think problems can be solved. There's a whole lot of other options in front of me besides representing my state in Congress.
So, yes, I think for the millennial generation, because of the disenchantment and frustration with government, and they're finding other ways and other means, and the internet has been a way that has helped that immensely. But the issues for young people and women and people of color to get the educational opportunities, to meet the people, to network, to raise the money, to have the appropriate capital necessary to run for office and be successful, those maintain across generations. Those things are not likely to go away anytime soon. And so I think what's different about this generation is that we are trying to make them more aware of those barriers, mm-hmm. which is good because if they want to cross them, they're armed to do so.
Right.
What could be bad about that is that it may, I don't know, inhibit their want to cross them, but then they find other ways to be useful, which is a good thing.
Which is good. Yeah. I have about 90 seconds left, but I want to say that Dean's message really resonated with me when I heard it mm-hmm. for Republicans and Democrats, because you look at the retirement of Orrin Hatch, what,
yes.
well into his age. I mean, there is an echelon in both parties of leaders who have stayed and stayed
yeah.
and stayed as if nobody else competent is out there and could
right.
do the job.
Right.
I wish our political system wasn't like that.
I agree with you. I agree. I mean, Congress, they're a bunch of old people. I hate to say that, and I don't mean that in an ageist way, but with that, you know, we need some fresh ideas to come in, and then also to inspire those that have not been represented in government before.
Yeah. Suzanne, really good to have you. I hope you'll come back.
I would love to. Thank you so
Great.
Much, Carrie.
Thank you. Suzanne Chaud, Associate Professor of Political Science at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois. Turn to us on Mondays for political coverage. I'll have some big questions to ask you, but we'll also just talk about the news of the day. That's Monday right here on NPR News.